Well, thank you very much for attending our elective this afternoon on the topic of waking up to woke, true and false righteousness in the Bible. And this, of course, is an area that holds great interest to us, and our lives are certainly being impacted by this mindset in our society. We're very privileged to have a wonderful panel of people joining us today, with Dan Patterson, Cindy McGarvey, and John Upham. Just to give you a little bit of background on each of them, Cindy, of course, is the National Director of Youth for Christ Australia, and she met husband Rod in the Australian Army. And following that, they went to Tanzania and Uganda and served with Wycliffe Bible Translators for around about 12 years and raised five children in that context. Cindy, of course, as you heard when Johanna was interviewing her this afternoon, is on the board of the Australian Institute of Family Counselling and Wycliffe Australia. And I have with me a couple of her books that are available. One recently released in 2022, The Next Revolution, which is speaking about resisting the cult of self, and Lost Boys, Bring Them Home, and well worth having a look. And there is another book for young ladies that's coming out in the not too distant future. So it's great to have you with us, Cindy. We also welcome Dan Patterson. Dan is the founder of Questioning Christianity, and that's a ministry that really helps us connect with the Christian story through life's deepest questions. Dan encourages young and old to ask the question, why? And he has certainly significant experience as a pastor, lecturer, and public speaker, having studied theology and apologetics in Australia and at Oxford University. Dan currently lives in Brisbane and his wife Erin, with his wife Erin, a wonderful lady and together they have a favourite job of raising three wonderful young men. I've had the privilege of having Dan mentor one of my sons, and he's just done a wonderful job in schools and in university settings and many other contexts in Australia and beyond. Our facilitator this afternoon, the initiator of our elective and our leader today, is John Upham. John became a follower of Jesus since at the age of 16, and he is married to Susan, has four adult children and six grandchildren. John works as a lung specialist at the PA Hospital and also as a medical researcher within the University of Queensland. He has a real passion for considering how the immune system functions and how environmental changes impact lung health. John is actually a member of our MTC board and is committed to applying biblical wisdom to contemporary ethical issues. So would you join me as we welcome our three panelists and our facilitator, Cindy, Dan, and John.
Thanks, Graham, and it's a wonderful privilege and honour to be here to lead this elective. Just to give you a little bit of an idea about the structure, I'm going to be talking for about 25 minutes or thereabouts, then we'll bring Dan and Cindy up onto the stage. We'll have a panel discussion about some of the issues that we've raised, but there will be plenty of time at the end for questions. So if you're listening and you suddenly have a question pops up in your mind, please write it down. Look, before we go further, I just do need to indicate that some of the material that we are about to dive into is not suitable for young children. So if you have someone less than the age of 12 with you, maybe we can tolerate a 6 or a 12-monther, but young children, this is not going to be a suitable elective for you. You perhaps should go to one of the other electives. So look, I hope that the material that we're going to go through will both challenge and encourage you this afternoon. And it's been wonderful this morning. I have really, really appreciated the sessions that we've had this morning, the worship, the lovely Bible teaching that we've had from our two speakers, and also what Cindy had to say in her little mission spot this morning in that video clip, which I certainly found very challenging and encouraging. But in particular, I'd like to focus on what Dan Wu had to say this morning about the book of Proverbs and the issue of wisdom. So Dan just spoke to us about the way that wisdom is the way that we think about the world, we think about God, we think about our passions, we think about the things that we do. And Dan didn't really talk about it that just this morning, but I'm sure he'll develop over the next few days, that wisdom is different to rule keeping. You can give someone a set of rules and say, do this, don't do that, do this, do this, do this, and they may not necessarily have any wisdom out of that. Wisdom is much more stepping back and thinking, what is the witness of Scripture? What is God saying to us about how we approach various issues? Now, Waking Up to Woke is in the title. I will be touching on the topic of woke, but woke may come and go. In 5 or 10 years' time, there might be something new that's taken over and woke has faded into the mists of time and we've got something else to worry about. I think what we really need to have is a biblical view by which we can look at all of the issues that come up through the world, regardless of what they might be. And that's why I think what I'm going to try and concentrate in the next few minutes is asking the question, what is true and false righteousness in the Bible? So the world in which we live, particularly the Western world, is rapidly changing, and you don't need me to tell you that. There are fewer Christians than there used to be, or at least people who identify as Christians. But before you get too depressed about that and think that the world is coming to an end and the kingdom of God is on the back foot, just remind yourself that there are many parts of the world where the gospel is rapidly spreading, where churches are growing, where people are coming to faith. Things may not be so good here in the Western world, in countries like Australia, but there are many other parts of the world where the gospel is rapidly advancing. The second thing that I'd point out is that church involvement has declined. It was going down, it's been going down for a number of decades. It's probably gone down worse as a result of COVID. But what a lot of Christians don't realise is that involvement in a whole range of other groups out in the community have gone down even more. So the numbers of people that are involved in clubs, in community groups, in service organisations, in the Scouts, the Lions, the Apex, all the PNCs, all of these sort of things, that's gone down even more. The third thing I'd say is that we live in a society where individual rights have been emphasised rather than individual responsibilities and what we call the common good. And finally, ethics and morality seems to be on shaky ground, or at least that seems to be the observation as we look around the world. Now, this issue of ethics and morality is going to be the focus of most of what I'll say over the next 20 minutes or so. But can I come back to point number 3, because I think that is something that we as Christians have not paid enough attention to. We have not realised that that has serious spiritual implications, because at the moment we have a situation where there are a lot of our Christian brothers and sisters, believers, who are not involved in church. They've been caught up in this reduced tendency for people in the world to join into groups and mingle with each other. There are a lot of our Christian brothers and sisters who are listening to sermons on YouTube and downloading worship songs, but they don't ever attend a local place of worship. And I think that's got serious spiritual implications and something that we need to address. But that's something for another day. Let's move on. So lots of other things are happening in the world around us. You don't need to tell me. The world seems to be paying much less attention to traditional values. Unfortunately, what seems to be happening is that the ethical and moral choices that people are making seem to align with their political allegiances rather than any sense of what's right and wrong, particularly rather than a biblically defined sense of what's right and wrong. Our society seems to value leaders on the basis of personality and charisma rather than character and virtue, and I think that's tragic. And finally, there's the sense that Christian voices are getting pushed to the margins, where once upon a time, not everyone in the world might agree with what Christians and what the church might have to say. Nowadays, we're being marginalised and much less welcome to add to discussions in the public square. So, this is a statement from Richard Dawkins, a very famous atheist. He made this statement nearly 30 years ago in a book that he wrote. He said, "The universe has no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." And a lot of people thought, "Oh, yeah, you're onto it, Richard. You know, we believe you." The thing is that almost nobody behaves as though this is true. And this applies not just to believers, but to atheists and agnostics. I don't know the religious affiliations of the young lady in the picture there who's holding up the sign about human trafficking. She may well be an atheist. Just about everybody, regardless of their religious beliefs or lack thereof, believes that there are right and wrong, and if something is wrong, I should get out there and protest about it and make a fuss. And that's because people realise that evil and good are important. Truth, goodness and justice are important. Now, people have very different ideas about what shape that might be, but everybody believes, and so no one actually believes, or no one puts into practice the statement that Richard Dawkins made up at the top. Now, as you look at a lot of the debates that are going on in society, the angry arguments that go on Facebook and social media and other areas, I would put it to you that a lot of those, and maybe almost all of those, are fundamentally discussions about goodness and justice rather than anything else. So, the outline of the talk, we're just going to address a couple of cultural debates. I'm going to mention woke, but perhaps not in quite as much detail as you might have hoped for. I'm not going to give you a list of my top 50 woke-isms. I think that's for all of us to decide once we understand the biblical principles. I think we need to learn Bible wisdom about truth, justice, and righteousness before we try to sort out the specifics. I'll speak also about equality and equity, which is something that's been quite in the public debate in the last year or so. But most of the time we'll be trying to provide some sort of an overview of what the Bible says about both true and false righteousness. Because I would argue that some of the issues that we're seeing around woke fall under the category of false righteousness, where people think they're doing something good, but as believers, as evangelical Christians with a strong scriptural basis, we look and say, that's not actually righteousness, that's false righteousness. And then at the end, we'll have a panel discussion with Cindy and Dave. And the three of us will come up. We'll spend a bit of time talking amongst ourselves, then we'll open up for questions. We're also going to spend a little bit of time thinking about how speaking out about various issues feeds in and is in tension sometimes with our desire to have gospel conversations with people. So we don't want to be so good at proclaiming truth, righteousness and justice that we bang people over the head and they have no appetite for engaging in a gospel conversation. And there'll be some pastoral care concerns that I'll bring up at the end as well. Okay, so woke and other slogans. David French, who's a Christian and a conservative commentator writing in the Dispatch recently, said that we live in a time when people would rather be loyal to slogans than to ideas. Personally, I'd paraphrase it slightly and say people would rather be loyal to slogans than to truth. So people want to shout slogans, they want to dump into Facebook and social media, et cetera, rather than thinking about truth. Now, an American politician that you may have heard of said this about woke. "I don't like the term woke. It's just the term they use. Half the people can't even define it. They don't know what it is." Now, if you're one of those people who don't really know what woke's about, you know that it's something bad, but you're not sure what it's all about, I'm going to help you in the next slide or two. So, where did it all start? So an African-American author by the name of William Kelly wrote an article back in 1962 about black slang. And he, in his article, defined woke as someone who had awoken, who was well-informed and up-to-date about issues, particularly in his context, thinking about racism. So woke is a shortened version of awoke or awoken. Later on, woke came to be expanded to other social justice issues. And so far, yeah, comfortable with all of that. What's happened, though, is that that original meaning is now fading, and more often we see it used in a critical or sarcastic way to describe what seems to be an obsession with identity, diversity, and inclusion to the point of absurdity. And that's the kind of issue that we have to deal with today. So, in my view, all this debate about what's woke and what's not woke is really a debate about what's right, good, and true. And the Bible's the best place to find out about that. So, a brief overview, and I'm not going to be able to talk everything about righteousness in the Bible. There are some highly esteemed Bible college lecturers who could do this way, way better than I, but I'm just going to do it, have a bit of an overview in the next 15 or 20 minutes. So in the Bible, there are two aspects to righteousness. One aspect is being in right relationship with God. This is a gift that we receive by faith. The second aspect is having attitudes, actions, and words that align with God's commands. And it's that second aspect that we're really going to be looking at this afternoon. It's really important at the beginning of this to say that it is God who defines what is right, good, and true. It's not up to us to define that. And God also expects us to earnestly desire these things. In the Beatitudes, Jesus tells us, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." And finally, I think as we look at the Bible, it's important that we have the right way of reading the Bible. We have to be prepared not just to study the Bible, but let the Bible study us. Someone whose name I've forgotten once said that the Bible is a window, not a mirror. It's a way through which we encounter God and understand what God is like. It is not a mirror that bounces back to us our prejudices, our ill-formed ideas, and our blind spots. So we always should look at the Bible as a window, not a mirror. Okay, we're going to dive right in. Let's look at Sodom and Gomorrah. This is why I didn't want any under 12s with us this afternoon. So just the background, most of what we're going to look at is in chapter 19, but chapter 18 just gives us a little bit of a brief background. God makes it very clear that he is very angry about what's happening in Sodom and Gomorrah. Judgment is at hand. The city's about to be destroyed. Abraham gets into a bit of a debate with God and pleads on behalf of the city and says, "Look, will you spare the city if I can find a small number of righteous people?" And those of you who remember the incident in detail, it starts out with 50 and then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually he says, how about five people? If I can find five people, will you spare the city? Turns out he can't find five people. Okay, so let's start reading from the beginning of Genesis chapter 19. And I'm going to read it from my notes. Okay. "The two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. 'My lords,' he said, 'please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet and spend the night and then go on your way early in the morning.' 'No,' they answered." So they as the angels, but they'll be referred to as men a bit later on. "No," they answered, "we will spend the night in the square." But Lot, I think, knew what Sodom was like, and so he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. Before they'd gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house, every man. They called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." Pretty blatant, really. Now, depending on what translation of your Bible, it may say "no them," but it's pretty clear as the story develops that "no" is not all "let's get to know you, shake hands, and share a few bit of conversation. We're talking about sex. Okay. So Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, "No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them. But don't do anything to these men, for they have come under the protection of my roof." "Get out of our way," they replied. "This fellow came here as a foreigner, and now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than them." They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. But the men inside... The men inside, that is the angels, reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness, so that they could not find the door. The two men said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we are going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it." So, pretty horrible situation. Why did God judge Sodom? Now, the first and most obvious thing, and the thing that most people are who are familiar with the story will say, is that it's all about lust and sexual immorality. And secondly, most people will say it's all about rampant homosexuality. But I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb and suggest to you that at least some of the men in Sodom were probably bisexual. I say that for two reasons. If you have a city in which all of the men are homosexual, there will be no babies born. The city will population will go down very, very rapidly. And the second reason I say that is that Lot makes an offer to send out his daughters, which we'll come to in a moment, pretty horrible offer, sends out his daughters that might satisfy the men. So that doesn't make sense if 100% of the men were 100% homosexual. I think some of the men were probably bisexual, but that's speculation on my part. Okay, but what else is going on? The men of the city have not invited the two heavenly visitors down to the local men's shed for a cup of tea and some olives. While the sun goes down, we can have a bit of getting to know you, and you know, maybe we'll build a relationship and we can share stories. There is no consent. This is effectively rape, and in fact, pack rape that is about to happen. This is horrible stuff. But more than that, there's power imbalance. At least the men of the city think that the power is on their side, but what they're basically assuming is they're pounding on the door and yelling, "Send out these men." They think because there's a lot of them, hundreds, thousands, however many there might be, and there's two of these men, these foreigners that have come in, they've got the power, therefore they've got the right to do what they like. And finally, I think that the men of the city, as much as there may be an erotic and a sexual and a lust aspect to it, I think the men of the city want to humiliate the visitors, the two men. Now, does any of this happen today? Of course it does. Whenever you hear incidents of sexual abuse, sexual coercion in the workplace, in schools, in churches even, sexual abuse, all these things are going on. It's fairly rare, fairly uncommon for sexual abuse, rape, sexual coercion, child abuse to happen just because of lust and sexual immorality. I spent a lot of my life in the kind of science world, and we have this saying sometimes when we're trying to sort out what caused something, we say that something is necessary but not sufficient. So you have to have it, but on its own, you usually need other things going on as well. So what I'd like to suggest to you here is that both in the story of Sodom and in the issues of sexual abuse, coercion, and child abuse and all these things, and rape, the whole thing is that, yes, lust and sexual immorality are there, but lack of consent is there. And haven't we seen discussions about that in the last year or so in Australia? Power imbalance is there, particularly in situations where people are coerced intersexual relationships in the workplace. Many of you will remember the example of Harvey Weinstein, the Hollywood producer who coerced a lot of young actresses who were working with him to go to bed with him. Now, there probably wasn't severe violence or anything like that, but they were coerced by a power imbalance. And the final thing, humiliation and abuse, is something that we see very, very much today. When survivors of child abuse, of sexual coercion are interviewed in the months and the years afterwards, the thing that usually stays with them for many, many years is a sense of humiliation and abuse. They feel that they've been humiliated, and that's often the worst aspect and the most long-lasting aspect. So I think this story has important resonances for some of the issues that we've seen in our society recently. So what about Lot? What about Lot's behaviour? And I think we can say there was good, bad and ugly. So what did he do that was good? Well, he gave hospitality to the heavenly visitors. He recognised that sleeping out in the square of the city had some hazards. He said, invited them home, he prepared a meal, and we'll give him a tick for that. He also confronted evil. When the men of the city started pounding on the door and said, send those men out so we can do what we want with them, he confronts them. He says, don't do this wicked thing. And again, I think we can give him a tick for that. But he doesn't ask for divine help. He's got a pair of angels with him. Now, you know, I guess it's easy to say in hindsight, but if I was in a really difficult situation and I had a pair of angels with me, I'd be thinking, maybe the angels can help in some way. And in the end, they ended up rescuing the situation by making the men who are pounding on the door blind. The very worst thing is Lot offered to send out his two daughters. Pardon me. You can do with them what you like. I'm a father of four daughters. I have six grandchildren. I am absolutely outraged when I read this. You know, I think we're sometimes a little bit soft on the characters in the Bible that we think are the heroes. We kind of, you know, they had some good points and a few weak points. This just totally outrages me that he thought the way to deal with the potential rape of the two angels was to send out his two daughters. They'd never had sex with a man. They were probably teenagers. What do you think that did for their moral and spiritual development? It can't have been good. In fact, it was horrible. And if you want to read on in Genesis some of the things that happened with Lot and his daughters in the next chapter or the one after, you'll understand what I mean. Okay. More about Sodom. So everyone knows that story in Genesis, but it's not the only place in the scriptures where Sodom is talked about. Sodom is often held up as the kind of archetypal example of a city that's rebelled against God, done evil things, and fallen under God's judgment. Over 1,000 years after the incident of Sodom and Gomorrah occurred, we read this part that's from Ezekiel chapter 16. Now, this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and the needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before me. Therefore, I did away with them, as you have seen. And there are a couple of passages in Isaiah that say very, very much the same thing. So what's going on? We've got two accounts of the evil that was going on in Sodom, one that focuses on sexual immorality, lack of consent and misuse of power. And the other one from Ezekiel and also the passages in Isaiah talk about Sodom being arrogant, overfed, proud, unconcerned about others, failing to help the poor and the needy. So is Genesis the Puritan or the woke version of what went on in Sodom? Is this the woke version of what went on in Sodom? Was Ezekiel a bleeding heart prophet who rewrote history to try and fit in with the concerns of his day? Certainly not. The scripture is unified. We can't separate, we can't pick and choose the sections that we want to like. Now, I reckon if we went out into society and read the passage in Sodom and Gomorrah to people from different parts of the political spectrum, some of them would cheer in the Genesis account and boo in the Ezekiel account, and there'd be other people who boo the Ezekiel account and cheer. So it's interesting. What I think is common to both accounts, and we can see as a thrust in the scripture, is that we need to stick to God's standards of morality, whether they be standards around sexual behaviour, consent. God calls us to love our neighbour as ourselves, to be generous, to practice hospitality, and to use power responsibly. And that comes out in both accounts. Okay, Jesus was asked, as I'm sure you all know, about what is the greatest commandment. A lawyer asked him this question, and he replied by quoting two passages from the Old Testament, one from Deuteronomy and one from Leviticus. The most important one, answered Jesus, is this: "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. The second is this: love your neighbour as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these." Now, we have a bit of a tendency to try and divide those. So we think, oh, I'll love God or I'll love people. But Jesus doesn't give us that liberty. These two aspects are intimately connected. It's not a matter of choosing this or that. The two things belong together. So in response to this question, the lawyer then asked him, so who's my neighbour? But I think what the lawyer was wanting to know was, where can I draw a line between my neighbour and the person who's not my neighbour? That's what the lawyer wanted to do. He wanted to kind of limit it so that the love of neighbour was manageable and something that he could kind of do and wouldn't be too challenging. But then Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan. That's a painting by Van Gogh, which I think eloquently shows what happened. Jesus reframes it and says to the lawyer, who was a neighbour to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? So rather than trying to limit who neighbour is, so these people here are neighbours, I should love them. These people here are not neighbours, don't need to worry about them. Jesus said, hang on a minute, isn't it all about looking for opportunities to be a neighbour to other people? So some other passages that describe how love of God and love of others cannot be separated. Just got myself slightly lost. Okay, the Bible affirms in multiple places that love of God and love of others cannot be separated. Isaiah told the people that God would not listen to their prayers unless they looked after the oppressed, the fatherless, and the widows. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus actually told people to postpone going to worship if there was a personal conflict that needed to be looked after. And the book of James reminds us that devotion to God involves looking after orphans and widows and keeping oneself unstained from the world. Similarly, Jesus made it very clear in his teaching that true righteousness is just not about outward behaviour. It involves transformation of the inner life. And there's two very, very similar passages, one dealing with murder and hate, or murder and anger, and another dealing with adultery and lust. You've heard it said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who's angry with his brother or sister will be subject to judgment. And similarly, a little bit later in this same passage, you've heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. On the side of the screen, you'll see I've put up a quote from John Wooden, who is a basketball coach in the States. I'd never heard of him before I prepared this talk. But he made a very salient observation. He said, the true test of a man's character is what he does when no one is watching. Yeah. I think as Christians, we realise that we're never actually alone, that how we behave, God sees what we do. Okay, Galatians, as you know, speaks very in a lot of detail about the fact that a tree is known by its fruits. Some of us are prone to problems like sexual immorality, moral impurity, and promiscuity. Others of us have issues with hatred, strife, and jealousy. Some of us are troubled by selfish ambition, dissension, factions, envy, drunkenness, etc., etc. What good news it is that the Holy Spirit comes to change our hearts from the inside and bring forth the famous fruits of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Jesus also spoke to us about the importance of goodness not being a performance. And this becomes incredibly relevant today, and I'll tell you in a little while. So he said, for example, be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you'll have no reward from your Father in heaven who sees. So when you give to the needy, or when you pray or you fast, do them in secret. Your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Some of you will be aware that there's a term in our society now called virtue signaling, where people do things or at least say they're going to do something on Facebook or some other form of social media, and they may or may not be actually going to follow through, but their main reason for doing this is to show the rest of the world that I'm a good person, that I'm doing the right thing. I think what Jesus is saying to us, that the antidote to virtue signaling is not to stop doing good things like giving to the needy, praying or fasting, but to avoid putting on a show. In this verse, Jesus reminds us of the importance of focusing on the most important things. The most important things are the most important. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill and cumin, but have neglected the more important matters of the law: justice, mercy and faithfulness. Now, I don't know about you. Does anyone tithe their spice cabinet? I don't. But I think I'm challenged. Is there something that I am doing where I'm spending way, way too much time on trivialities rather than focusing on the most important? And I think each of us can have a think and reflect on where we might be running into issues. Okay, so just to summarise this section of the talk, true righteousness involves, in the true biblical righteousness, involves love of God and love of others, whereas false righteousness tends to choose. You either love God and you're a bit like a Pharisee, or you love others, but you forget about loving God. True righteousness seeks to please God, whereas false righteousness draws attention to itself. True righteousness involves inner transformation, leading to changes in outward behaviour, whereas false righteousness says inner transformation doesn't really matter. It's all about keeping the rules on the outside. True righteousness focuses on the most important, whereas false righteousness is distracted by lesser things. And kind of going back to what we saw in the accounts of Sodom and Gomorrah, generosity, hospitality, responsible use of power and servanthood are all really important. Okay, I'm conscious I'm going a little bit slower than I thought I was, but I just want to briefly discuss equality and equity, which is a little bit off to the side, but I think important in the current situation nonetheless. So, equality. The Bible has a lot to say about equality. It tells us that God created all people in his own image and that he doesn't show favouritism. This famous verse from Matthew 5, I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Anyone got enemies on their prayer list? Yep, bit of a challenge, isn't it? That you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. This is something the theologians call common grace, which the late Tim Keller has defined as a desire on God's part to bestow certain blessings on all human beings, believers and non-believers alike. So equality, people have realised, this is a really important underlying foundation for society. In the preamble to the American Declaration of Independence, they state, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And I think that's been a really, really important document for America as a nation. Equality says that human worth is not inherited. It's a strong basis for justice and human rights. It encourages effort and personal responsibility. But sometimes what happens, particularly in a world of broken, sinful people, you see the situation where of survival of the fittest, where the people who seem to do particularly well and get rewarded in our society are the strong, the wealthy, the beautiful, and the educated. The Bible, to kind of counter this, has another balance in its witness, and it talks very much through the Old Testament and the New Testament about providing extra care for the disadvantaged. And I've just put up two examples from the Old Testament. Don't go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes. Leave them for the poor and the foreigner. I am the Lord your God. And in Deuteronomy, when you finish setting aside a tenth of all your produce in the third year, the year of the tithe, you shall give it to the Levites, one of the priestly classes, the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow, so that they may eat in your towns and be satisfied. Now, I wonder if back in Moses' day, some of the people said, oh, not sure about that. Do these disadvantaged groups really deserve to be looked after? Don't all lives matter? So, as a consequence, there's this concept that we balance with equality of equity. Now, you see here a little cartoon that describes the difference very nicely. So, on the left-hand side, you've got three people, presumably from the one family, trying to watch a baseball game. They've each got one box to stand on. The dad and the older son can see over the fence and watch the game, but the little guy cannot see over the game. If rather than distributing the boxes equally, you do them in terms of equity, so in other words, in terms of need, the dad has no box, the older son has one box, the little son has two boxes, they can all see over the fence. Make sense? So equity recognises fairness and justice and provides a way to address disadvantage. I think as Christians we should always be advocating for better opportunities for the disadvantaged without necessarily expecting that the outcomes are going to be identical. I think that's very, very hard to do anything about. And finally, choosing whether equality or equity is the best in any particular situation, I think requires great wisdom, going back to what Dan Wu was saying from Proverbs this morning. So if you want a kind of a very trivial or simple example of this, think about our federal parliament. We have two houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate. In the House of Representatives, all the electorates have essentially the same number of voters, so everyone's vote is identical. So it's a good example of equality across the board. And we all think, oh, that's a really good thing. But the founding fathers of Federation were wise people, and they realised that in that sort of situation, the bigger states would dominate and the smaller states would miss out. So they set up the Senate, and in the Senate, each state, regardless of size, has the same number of representatives. And what this effectively means is that if you live in Tasmania, your vote is worth 10 times what it might be in New South Wales. Now, if you live in New South Wales, you think, oh, it's a little bit unfair. If you live in Tasmania, you think, wow, that's wonderful, that's wonderful. But I think it's a good example about how equality and equity both have their place, and sometimes you need kind of both approaches to do the right thing. Okay, we're getting towards the close, and apologies, I'm going a little bit over time, Graham. So speaking out, when is it appropriate to use the word woke? Look, I think there are some things that we can all recognise are clearly wrong and they're contrary to the scriptures. I think go for it. I'm not going to give you a list, as I said, of 50 top woke things. Most of us can recognise them without any trouble. I think what's a little bit trickier, though, is where there's a genuine problem or need underlying it, but the proposed solution seems contrary to the scriptures. And I guess one example that comes to my mind is the large number of 10, 12-year-old, 13-year-old kids in our society today who have gender confusion, who are being put up for hormone treatment or sex change surgery or whatever. Now, the hormone treatment, the sex change surgery, we look at that and we go, no, that's just got to be wrong. But there's an issue underneath. There are a bunch of 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old kids who are very distressed, who have mental health needs, who are anxious, who are depressed, who need nurturing, hugging, looking after, supporting, so that they can transition through this difficult journey. So I think if we are going to say that this whole thing is woke, we need to be aware that there's often an underlying need that we need to be right in there as Christians addressing. We do need to pause though, because sometimes I see woke used as a way of shutting down debate about things that we don't really want to talk about. You know, we don't really want to have to confront the issues around sexual abuse and sexual misconduct within the church because it makes us squirm and we don't like it. But we can't just pretend it's not there. If we are people who believe in righteousness, who believe in sin, who believe in confession and forgiveness and restoration, we've got to tackle some of these issues. We can't just use woke as a way of shutting things down. And I've put a quote there from another journalist, Jonah Goldberg, again, a conservative. I think he's comes from a Jewish background. He says, woke is just another word for things that make us mad. So if we are going to use woke, don't use it in that situation. Find another way of tackling the situation. I think we also need to affirm freedom of conscience amongst Christians. This goes right back to the Reformation, where it's been a core value of most Protestant denominations. We realise that there are certain things that are essentials, where we need to have unity. There are non-essentials, where we need to have liberty, and in all things, we need to have charity. So in our midst, for example, there are probably some different approaches to how we celebrate communion or baptism. People have differing ideas about the end times, and there are the amillennials and the premillennials and the postmillennials. They're probably not the sort of issues we should be throwing the word woke around or speaking in a disrespectful sort of way. And finally, I think we need to be careful, because if we use woke in a sarcastic or grumpy or critical way, it's not always the best way to communicate a gospel truth. A good example would be when the Apostle Paul went to Athens, to Mars Hill, to speak to the philosophers. He didn't go in and start his address by saying, "Ah, you're a bunch of idol-worshipping losers. You're all going to hell. Can I tell you about Jesus?" Rather, he looked for a bridge. He said, "Oh, look, I've noticed you've got a statue to the unknown God. Let me tell you about that unknown God." And so even though Paul was probably incredibly distressed and upset about all the idols around the square, he somehow managed to find a bridge through which he was able to share the gospel. So, a couple more slides. I think when we speak out into society, we have to have a think about, what are we planning to do? Are we going to be the crusading knight on the left-hand side? And I think that's entirely appropriate sometimes when we're defending the faith, when we're standing up for important values around righteousness and justice. Or are we going to be the sower? You'll see, again, I'm a bit of a fan of Van Gogh. This is the sower at sunset. The sower whose aim is to spread the gospel far and wide. And I think, in my view, it's really a matter of godly wisdom and prayer and asking the Holy Spirit to guide us. Because I think there are times when we need to be like that crusader warrior. There are other times when we need to be like that sower. And the other thing I think that we need to think about is to whom are we talking? Now, and I'll set this in a context of a survey that was done by McCrindle Research back in 2019, where they asked many thousands of people across Australia for their attitudes about Christianity. And you'll see on that thermometer there, about 38% of people considered themselves Christian, there's about 20-something percent were warm to Christianity. Might not have felt they were Christians, but they had a lot of sympathy and understanding for Christianity. About 12% of people were neutral, and about a quarter were very cool or cold on the gospel. I think if we talk about woke and to the groups up the top of the thing, so the Christians and the people who are warm, they're going to kind of understand where we're coming from. We're going to have a good audience. We'll be able to have a discussion and, you know, move forward. But I think when we go down to the bottom of the scale, if someone who is strongly opposed to Christianity hears you talking or telling them that they're woke, you've got to work out really carefully, what are you actually trying to achieve, and are you going to put them off? Are you going to antagonise them further? These are difficult questions. I don't think we've got any obvious answers for how to tackle this. Okay, summary. God's word says a lot about what's right, good, and true, and that's where we should be going. We need to listen to God's word, reflect, and obey. And really importantly, when it comes to righteousness, Jesus is the source of all that is right, good, and true. Sometimes in ethical discussions, it kind of ends up being a list of rules and kind of going back to the Old Testament law. We have to remember that Jesus is the source of all that is right, good, and true. We have to listen carefully, I think, to the people we meet in the world around us, because sometimes there are issues that bubble up out of society, cries of anguish, cries of need, and all of a sudden we bring it to the Lord in prayer and we think, hang on a minute, the scriptures actually talk about that. But if we're not listening to what the world's saying, if we're not listening to what our friends, our work colleagues are saying, we might miss some of those issues. The approach we have, I think, is very, very different if we're talking in public or one-on-one, because you know, that's obvious. We need to try and identify common concerns when we're approaching contentious issues. So it's time to stop. I'll get Cindy and Dan to come up on the stage and we're going to have a little bit of a discussion. So, oh, there they are. So unfortunately, we don't have a roving microphone. So when it comes time for questions, you're just going to have to speak in a loud voice. But I've got a couple of questions for Dan and Cindy to tackle before we jump into questions from the floor. And again, I apologise, I've gone a little bit later than I planned. Okay, this one's going to be for Cindy. And I have pre-warned her about this. So you're on the church welcome team. Does anyone know who the lady in the photo is? So the pastor's told you that there's an Alpha course starting in a few weeks. Just after the service starts, this young woman arrives and sits in the back row, and you go over and start talking to her. Her face looks familiar, and you find out that she's Chantel Contos. Now, for those of you who don't know, a few years ago, she put out a post on social media asking young Australian women to tell her if they'd been sexually assaulted. She got over 5,000 stories of young teenage girls who'd been sexually assaulted. She ended up asked for people to sign a petition asking the government to do something, and I think she had 400,000 people signed up. Since then, she's decided that the way to solve this problem is to run consent education in school, maybe even down in primary school. I don't 100% know about that. So, Cindy, you've got a few misgivings about consent education as a way to tackle this problem, and it's obviously something that you've thought about in your work. But you decide that you're not going to tell her that she's woke. What are you going to say to her, and how do you think you're going to approach the conversation?
Yeah, I didn't know who this young lady was, actually, but I remember that whole thing, so I hadn't remembered her name. So if I was an usher, I think that says something about being an usher or whatever.
Yeah, you're on the welcome team.
Yeah, if I'm on the welcome team, I would just do my job. But if I had the time and opportunity to have a conversation with her, you know, I'd probably just ask her a whole bunch of questions. But obviously she's coming from a point of view that it does not have a biblical worldview. So it was interesting that of all the stories she got back, that she asked the question about having sexual abuse experience from schoolboys in Sydney, yep. I think
yeah,
they were.
That's right.
So they weren't men outside school or anything like that. It was just other schoolboys. And I can remember I was very interested in it at the time, and I researched it and found that there was one school principal. He said, the whole problem with this is pornography. It's just rife in our schools. And, you know, with the young men feeding that into their brains, and, you know, obviously what I've shared earlier fits quite well into that. So I think consent is all you can do. If you don't have a biblical worldview, consent is maybe a helpful thing to help people, because if you don't believe that feeding your mind with pornography and living in the sexualized culture absorbing all of that, all of those morals and principles, well, that's really, that makes sense that you would just have to have consent, teach people to give consent. But from a biblical worldview, we know that the underlying problem is, you know, immorality. If there's no God, there's no morality, no rules, no laws, all that sort of thing, you really can just do what you want. But I see consent is really just a band-aid to a very bad problem that is rising. I know that in the UK, when I wrote my book Lost Boys, they were saying in primary school that sexual assault with children, child-on-child sexual assault, had risen 400%. And this was in secular studies. It was in a secular newspaper. Little children were watching pornography, some of the most worst pornography, and they were playing it out on their peers at school. This is primary school. All of the research that I did with asking and interviewing young men, most of them all were introduced by their peers to pornography at school. And, you know, we know in Queensland and in every state you have to have a blue card, a working with children check. But the pushers of porn are the children. Yep. So you just have to be super careful with that. So. Sure. I don't know if I fully answered the question,
I think, yeah. Just coming back to the consent issue, I've been married 43 years now. Some of you in the room probably longer, some shorter. If you're really honest with yourself and your marriage, even within a marriage where you've known someone for a long period of time and there's long-term commitment, sorting out consent can sometimes be really hard, not just in a sexual sense, but making family decisions about, you know, shall we go on a holiday? Shall we do this? Shall we do that? And you know, you can say, oh, let's do that. And what do you think of that? And the partner might say, fine, but fine might mean all sorts of things. And so sorting out decision-making in a long-term relationship has some complications. How do you sort out consent in the setting of someone that you're just going out on a first date or a second date? Completely crazy from my point of view.
Yeah, you made some good points.
Okay, one for you, Dan. So many people in our society champion diversity, inclusion, and protecting the vulnerable. Is this a threat or an opportunity for Christians?
Yeah, interesting question, and always one, I think, where that prayer for wisdom has to be our first guiding light. As you look across the scriptural story, I think as Christians, we've been on the front foot in responding to a God whose vision is global and the inclusion of all people who put their hope and trust in Jesus. You think of the eternal family that'll gather around the throne to worship Jesus, people of every tribe and tongue. You think of God's specific heart for the widow and the orphan and the foreigner and the stranger. You think of true religion that God our Father accepts as pure as this, to keep oneself unspotted from the world, certainly, but also to make sure that you have that same concern for the widow and the orphan. And so we're looking at dynamics where there is social inequalities that have historical realities, and what can we do to address that heartfelt concern, provide justice when it comes to legal guilt and innocence, but also mercy and welfare, which are core biblical outflowings of the compassion that flows from the heart of God. And so when it comes into writing that into particular policy, I think a lot of how this happens ends up being harmful, because it does create attitudes towards entire groups of people that begins to discriminate on the very things that we don't want to discriminate on, and it ends up bringing more racial division, less actual diversity in terms of people's love and enjoyment together. But I think there maybe are other ways that, and as we pray for wisdom, God, how do we address the systemic challenges? How do we address the core inadequacies for those that really are disadvantaged? What does it look like to address more on the socioeconomic factors than it is any other key thing to do with skin color or culture or elements? How do we address those in a way that actually lifts people up so that they can take their best place within our society? I think Christians need to recognize here not just the policy and go to attack something that you think undermines beautiful equality of all people being made in God's image, but be aware of what's driving people to get there. And I think this is the bridge that you were talking about before. There is a concern, you'll see inequality that's out there. The concern is, what are we doing about this? And when Christians may get upset at how some of these things end up in a particular policy, DEI inclusion policies, for instance, and not recognize, yeah, we actually see God's heart for the disadvantaged, for the downtrodden, for the people without a voice, for those who are on the margins of society. And we want to take our place as well in helping undo many of the systemic injustices that perhaps ended up being in this result. But we may have a different answer as to what that is. Sure. And it may take a greater change of heart to actually loving one another, as you said before, so that this isn't just something that's imposed from the outside as a policy, but it's genuine, rich relationships from Christians loving and being part of their communities that are looking to where there are needs and how we can help people as best as we're able to move beyond them. So I think that bridge is where Christians need to start. A broken heart, compassion, care for the people that maybe are disadvantaged. And we can speak then, if we have that same language of compassion, to the merits of particular policy development or ideologies as to how they're doing, and offer real critique, but not leading with critique and ignoring the compassion that's the thing that's driving it, that we should have oodles of as followers of Jesus.
I agree, and I think it's really interesting in the diversity issue and the whole Rainbow Coalition, the LGBTIQI, I forget all the letters, you know what I mean. There's a proclamation that this is all about diversity, but what you see is, for some reason, there's a pecking order amongst the diversity. So whereas once upon a time we were quite happy with the notion that women needed separate bathrooms and toilets and women's sport was to be celebrated and encouraged, now some of the transgender people want to come in and elbow their way in and kind of steamroller over the top of the women that have won these, you know, really important rights. And they've even been, for example, non-Christian feminists who've spoken out against this, who've been attacked, who've been told that they'll lose their jobs for daring to suggest that they would not like a transgender person who used to be a man working in a woman's refuge that's supporting women who are the victims of domestic violence. I mean, that's completely bizarre and kind of elevating, having this situation where all diversities are equal, but some diversities are more equal than others. Yeah.
Can I speak to that for just a quick second? We did a video on our YouTube channel called Is God Anti-Trans? And this may be a helpful example of this. I think there's a huge amount of concern, culturally speaking, that some of the decisions that have been made, particularly at governmental levels, and then policy that's sort of written down a lot within corporations, have ended up introducing realities for people that are deeply unsettling. And I think there was a silent majority for a while, culturally speaking, of people said, this is a bit strange or odd, but whatever, it's not going to have too much of a negative impact. But then I've seen maybe some of the practical outworkings with people put into very vulnerable positions, girls with bathrooms, people put into feeling like they've been pushed out of their own sporting fields or opportunities that were there. And people have responded, culturally speaking, and said, no, wait, this is way too much, a bridge too far. And you're seeing at the moment a huge political backswing, and I would say this is most of the Western world, where the conservative voice politically is having a much greater win, rhetorically speaking, in the engagement of ideas by showing the extreme outworkings and saying, look at how terrible this ideology is. Now, the people that are genuinely vulnerable in the middle there are also certainly some of the people that have been affected by the policies, but there are a huge number of Aussies, at least a few thousand, who experience genuine gender dysphoria, and as a result are incredibly vulnerable with the mental health outcomes that they'll experience. It's a very dangerous thing if Christians tie their cart to the political horse of conservative politics at this point and join in with that backlash, that will end up having just as much damage on the most vulnerable right there in the center. People that are getting caught up in the ideological battle back and forth, but are just wondering, how do I make sense of my broken experience? How do I make sense of who I am and why I'm here and whether I'm loved, and I don't feel like things are right? And I think Christians need to be able to offer healthy, godly, biblical answers to those questions, but again, to be led by compassion as to the thing that's driving it, not just truth. They need to be held together. And so that political backswing for both of us, neither to the left, neither to the right, what does it mean to follow the Lord of glory and to be able to represent his heart for the broken, as well as then wisdom in how we work out policies that don't end up hurting the vast majority of society as well. Individual care for the downtrodden and those who are struggling with the fallen reality of our minds and our bodies, but also then the common good. How do we walk that path as a light?
Yeah. Thanks, Dan.
Dan, I just want to personally say how much in some of the schools context we've appreciated some of those video clips of yours. In particular, that one is God Anti-Trans, which is clearly biblically based and also compassionate in terms of delivery. And we really appreciate that. And we thank you for being part of our panel. And Cindy, thank you so much for being a part of our panel today. And many of us are really looking forward to getting into some of the books that you've read that are available for purchase this weekend, which is great. Thank you to John for his leadership and initiation of this. Would you please join me in thanking our panelists?